From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Animal House, Caddyshack, Stripes, Meatballs, Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, and Analyze This. Harold Ramis co-wrote and or directed all of those films. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ramis about his long career in comedy and about working with John Belushi and Bill Murray. He directed the new movie The Ice Harvest, which stars John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Mary Gaitskell's new novel, Veronica. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Harold Ramis is one of the reasons why several early cast members of Saturday Night Live made it big in movies. Ramis co-wrote Animal House. He co-wrote and directed Caddyshack. He co-wrote Meatballs, Stripes, and Ghostbusters, which all starred Bill Murray, and he directed Murray in Groundhog Day. Ramis also directed and co-wrote Analyze This. He directed the new film, The Ice Harvest, which opens this week. It stars John Cusack as a sleazy lawyer who, along with a sleazy associate, played by Billy Bob Thornton, embezzles $2 million. Then the double crosses begin. In this scene, from early in the film, the two characters are talking in a restaurant.
Let me ask you something. Did I make a mistake when I made you my partner in this deal?
Hey, you didn't make me your partner. I am the one who showed you how to steal $2 million worth of Bill Gerard's money. Then I showed you how to do it so he wouldn't know what you'd done till it was too late.
What we've done, okay? Remember that, what we've done. And here's the thing about what we've done.
Mr. Arbliss?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Left to yourself, you'd still be on a bar stool thinking about how it could be done if somebody had the to do it. Which is me.
Harold Ramis, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
The tone of The Ice Harvest is kind of a hybrid of film noir and comedy. And at the end of the film, I will say, there are some violent scenes. And when you're doing that kind of violence in a film that has a lot of comic elements to it, what tone do you want to get with the violence? Like, what? How did you kind of figure out how much you wanted that to hurt or be comic or what?
Well, I wanted it to be really painful. I mean, to say the film is a comedy, which is kind of the way it's being sold, is somewhat misleading. It's very funny, but it's not funny because people are telling jokes or doing shtick or, you know, taking big falls that have nothing to do with what's going on in the film. All the big laughs come from the painful reality of it all, or from a really refined sense of irony that the characters have and that the writers have. So the violence is also a genuine and real part of the story, and I think both comedy and violence should hurt in a certain way. The biggest laughs come when people are kind of shocked or deeply humiliated by something that's said, or publicly embarrassed about something they feel and haven't been able to acknowledge that's acknowledged for them on the screen. So the closer you can come to what's really on people's minds, the bigger the laughs are going to be. And the closer you can come to making violence painful, I think that's the only kind of justified violence in films. I have teenage kids, and I see a lot of action films, and to me, that's a disturbing kind of violence, action violence, where you don't see blood and the victims are all strangers, so you're not supposed to care about them because there are lots of them. And it's kind of us against them. But real violence in a film is not attractive to young people. It's not attractive to anybody. The violence in The Ice Harvest, no one would want to experience. It's not fun and it's not cool.
There's a scene where the John Cusack and Oliver Platt characters are stopped at a streetlight. And John Cusack tells a story about his uncle and his father to Oliver Platt. Would you tell us that story, basically? You could do a shorter version if you'd like. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. Well, that story is the real core of the film. You know, the film is basically it's an existential riff, really. And the speech that John gives, he tells Oliver Platt, his drunken best friend, that his father had a twin brother. They were fraternal twins. And his father was a straight-by-the-book kind of guy. He was a cop. He wanted his only son to be a lawyer. Didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't chase women, always paid his taxes, voted in every election, not just for president, he says. And then Oliver says, and your uncle didn't vote. And John says, no, worse than that. He was total profligate, drank all the time, chased women in and out of jail, had lost a part of a toe in a bar fight, you know. His father died of a massive embolism in Wichita, and his uncle died the next day in California in a car accident. So John says, so what's the difference what you do in life? Same outcome. And that is the core of the movie. These are characters who have lost all sense of meaning in their lives. And the film kind of depicts what happens when you act without kind of a guiding set of values.
Did that story have anything to do with why you wanted to make the movie?
Yeah, well, I've been kind of creating a hybrid personal philosophy that's kind of a blend of existential psychology, Buddhism, and kind of progressive Judaism. And I kind of describe myself as an existentialist, and in the sense that I believe that it's the essential task to leading a good life is to discover meaning at all times, that meaning is not given to us. There is no universal meaning to life that applies now and for always for each and every person. That our job, and it's a tough job, is to figure out what it all means, and to fulfill, you know, a personal destiny that we each figure out for ourselves. And I think the film I did, Groundhog Day, was the kind of the positive expression of that idea. Bill Murray plays a character who's been desperately searching for meaning because he's trapped in the same day and doesn't know what it means or why. And in this film, also trapped in one day, the whole film takes place Christmas Eve, this is the downside. What happens if you don't discover meaning in your life?
Yeah, and in Groundhog Day, it leads to a kind of enlightenment.
Right, and a release, yeah. Redemption.
Now, what you're talking about, you know, the dangers of living life without meaning, without finding meaning or creating meaning, it makes me think, too, of Animal House in a way, because that's the kind of, like, comic anarchic version of the same point, because, like, all the guys there are in a way living life without meaning, and it's just about getting, you know, drunk or having sex or seeking the next thrill.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're young, you know, that's kind of age-appropriate. It's the job of youth to seek thrills and rebel against all known authority and kind of make your own rules, and then you get a little older and you get a little tired of that, and you start discovering a new purpose to life, hopefully. I always think if I were still making films like Animal House or Caddyshack, my early stuff, or Stripes, you know, people would start to worry about me at this age, I think.
Early in your comedy career, you were a joke editor for Playboy magazine.
And yes, I was.
I'm wondering if that was a really odd experience for you, because by that point you were probably part of, you know, the counterculture, and I think there was a kind of almost generation gap in humor then between, like, the old school and the new school, and Playboy, I think it's safe to say, represented the old school then, you know, kind of like titillating sex jokes at a time when a lot of people were being so kind of upfront about sex that the titillating sex jokes just seemed so archaic.
Well, you know, it's funny. I came to Playboy not because I was a reader or a huge fan of the magazine. Growing up in Chicago, Playboy was one of the major publishing enterprises in the city, along with four daily newspapers. So I started out freelancing for one of the daily papers, writing entertainment features, and then I got hired at Playboy. So it was just like a very good job for someone not long out of college. And I did the jokes for a few months and then became an assistant editor and then an associate editor, and I started doing other kinds of house copy. But yeah, I was, along with one or two other editors, we were the young long hairs at Playboy, and they kept asking us how the company could change and evolve to keep pace with this new generation that was not like the Playboy generation that Hugh Hefner had come from.
Now, your first television work, I think, was being head writer at SCTV?
Yeah, well, I came out of I was on stage at Second City in the late 60s, early 70s. In fact, overlapping at Playboy. For a while, I did 8 shows a week at Second City and worked 40 hours a week at the magazine. It was pretty intense, but really kind of satisfying and exciting.
And who was on the cast of SCTV when you worked on it?
Well, on the TV show, it was John Candy and Eugene Levy and Joe Flaherty, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, Dave Thomas. And then eventually Rick Moranis and Marty Short joined the show. But on stage at Second City, it was me and Brian Murray and John Belushi were the most notable people when I was on stage. And then John Belushi took a bunch of us to the National Lampoon with him. And we all kind of got established in New York at that point.
Is there a sketch or a character that you created for SCTV that you could tell us about?
I played a character called Mo Green, which Joe Flaherty gave me the name based on the account, the hotel owner in The Godfather. But I was the kind of Weasley accountant, station manager at assistant station manager at the fictional SCTV network, and I always played. I played a lot of weasels, a lot of cowards. Sweating cowards was my thing. I used to play like hippies and counterculture guys, and Belushi kind of took that over. So I moved into the coward role. Whenever there was a gang improv, we would do shipwreck improvs or the Flight of the Phoenix, the downed plane, and there was only enough food to go, you know, for all of us to have a little bit if we rationed it. And I was the guy who ate all the food while everyone else was asleep, you know. I kind of enjoyed that role. The other thing I would always play was a character called Specs or the Professor. Whenever there was I'd play the brainy guy, which I ended up doing, of course, in Ghostbusters.
Oh, that's right. And you were, like in Ghostbusters, you're the kind of like straight man.
Yeah.
In this crazy comedy?
Oh, yeah. And well, we always said that my character was the brains of the Ghostbusters. Dan Aykroyd's character was the heart, and Bill Murray's character was the mouth.
Did you ever feel like you were the straight man off-screen as well as on-screen?
Yeah, I mean, people asked me if I was the class clown. I said, no, I wrote for the class clown, which was kind of true.
Right.
I have a strange imagination and some very odd desires, but I don't have the courage to actually act them out. But there's always, I always gravitated toward the person with very little impulse control. Just could, I would give them a suggestion, and then that person would do it.
Well, the person with little impulse control, I mean, that's probably a great definition of John Belushi.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, he was, he really knew what he was doing. I mean, John was a very smart actor. Not the most verbal actor. And Bill Murray also, very brave, would do things I would never consider doing.
Like what?
Just saying things to people, saying the most outrageous things, or saying the most truthful things in a context where it was impolite to actually say the truth.
That could be awkward.
Very awkward. More than awkward. It was almost like a teaching in a certain way. Not just puncture someone, the propriety, but shatter it, just explode it.
Can you give an example of that?
Some of it was physical. We were walking down the street in New York when we were shooting Ghostbusters, and people always recognized Danny and Bill from Saturday Night. And someone, a stranger, walked up to Bill and said, "Hey, Bill, I love your work." And I don't know why, but Bill felt the need to wrestle him to the ground, a total stranger. And of course, you know, the stranger wasn't expecting that. He was just a fan, you know, but he got a lot more than he expected. And I don't know what that said to him, but or what it says about Bill, just that he was always defying people's expectations.
Is it because he felt his privacy was violated, or is it something more oblique than that?
It wasn't even angry. It was more like, you know, you want to talk to me? Okay, you know, this is what you get when you talk to me.
More intimate,
and like,
than just
that's
talk.
Why I say it's like a teaching. You know, some gurus teach by their actions, others by their words. Bill acted.
So you see something as oblique as that as almost being like Zen Koan, like you figure out what it means.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it was clear what it meant. Sometimes if it was hostile or angry, it was, you know, get away from me, or, you know, this is intrusive. But he, you know, he went around like the great Avenger, you know, kind of challenging illegitimate authority whenever he could, or attacking people that he thought deserved it.
My guest is Harold Ramis. He directed the new film, The Ice Harvest. He co-wrote Animal House and Ghostbusters and directed Groundhog Day. He co-wrote and directed Analyze This. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold Ramis, and the new film that he directed is called The Ice Harvest. We were talking a little bit about you being like the straight man or the adult figure in sketches, but also in life sometimes. And let's go to the set of Animal House. Now, you were one of the writers of the film.
Yeah, I wrote it with Doug Kenny and Chris Miller.
And the film is so much about, you know, Id's unleashed, you know, particularly the Belushi character himself.
But that's how we thought of college. You know, college, you go away to college and there's no parental authority and you're living alone with other not yet adults. But, you know, you're more than teenagers. It's an amazing sense of liberation, at least the way I experienced it.
Okay, so this is like an early film in everyone's career. Was there a party atmosphere on the set that was similar to the one in the movie? And did you feel like you had to kind of maintain order to get help get the job done? Yeah.
Well, the fact is that having written the film, I actually harbored the desire to direct it, as did Ivan Reitman, who produced it. But John Landis got the job. And then I auditioned for a major role in the film, the part that was played by Peter Riegert. And he was great in the film. I have no problem with Peter Riegert. But I didn't get the part. And having already been a professional actor for several years, I didn't want to be an extra in the film I'd written. So I actually went off. I returned to Greece, where I'd spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time on a Greek island. And I went to Greece to actually write another screenplay for John Landis to direct to follow Animal House. I wasn't even there. I wasn't even sure that the movie had started shooting until I got a letter from Chris Miller saying that the movie was being shot and was going very well. And then I returned to the States to see one of the early edits of the film, and I thought John had actually done a very effective job on it. So I missed the whole experience of shooting it, but I felt like I'd lived that somehow. So I didn't feel I'd missed much. And it would have killed me to stand around all day watching John Landis direct.
That's interesting. So you weren't even there. I know there are three writers on the film. So can you choose a scene that you wrote or rewrote that we could then play a clip of?
Oh, well, we all wrote together pretty much. But the way we did it was we sat down and debriefed ourselves totally on our college experiences. Each of us said everything we remembered and every one we remembered from college that seemed funny to us or outrageous or just horrible and shocking. And then we said everything that our brothers had told us or our fathers or uncles or everyone we knew. And then we threw in all the college apocrypha that we knew, all the stories that circulated, you know, forever about things that happened or might have happened on other campuses. So from that, characters started to emerge and storylines started to emerge. And so we divided the script in thirds, and each of us wrote a third, and then we swapped, and each of us rewrote a third we didn't write, and then we swapped again. So each of us had input on each section of the film. I think I worked hard on the John Belushi has a rallying speech where the Deltas are really down. They've sort of been kicked out of school, and there's a key line. He says, "Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?" No. And so I worked on that speech. And it's people sometimes quote that speech.
Oh, often.
Yeah.
Why don't we play that little rallying cry? Here it is.
Feel free.
Hey! What's this lying around? Well, what the hell is supposed to do, you moron?
War's over, man. Wormer dropped the big one.
What? Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is. Was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Hell no!
German? Forget it, he's rolling.
And it ain't over now. Because when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Who's with me? Let's go! Come on!
So, if the stories in Animal House were based on stories that actually happened to you and the other writers, or your brothers, plus some apocryphal stories, which of those stories actually happened to you?
Well, we all had the experience when we compared notes of going to an all-girls school to find dates. They go to Emily Dickinson College to look for girls, and they... they've read in the Dickinson newspaper a story about a it said a sophomore dies in kiln explosion, and they pretend that
excuse me,
Tim Matheson pretends he had a date lined up with the deceased girl, Fawn Leibowitz, or I think was her name.
There's a scene where several of the collegiate frat members go to a bar to hear a band, and they realize when they get in, they're the only white people there. Whose experience was
that? That was our real experience also. Both Chris and I had that experience, and maybe every college student had that experience. But I went to school at Washington University in St. Louis. We used to go to a place called Leo's Blue Note Club in East St. Louis, and the guitarist with the house band was Benny Sharp and the Sharpies, and he was really a great guitar player. Almost B.B. King kind of great. And we were often the only white people in the bar. And the actual line, "Can we dance with your dates?" happened to me, not at that club, but at another club.
And what did you say?
Of course, sure. We abandoned our dates in a moment. But, you know, that was all conceived as kind of, I mean, it was perceived as being right on the edge of being racist, but we just thought it was kind of a realistic portrayal of race relations in the early 60s.
Harold Ramis directed the new film, The Ice Harvest, which opens this week. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, you know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anthony Trollope's satire of money madness, The Way We Live Now, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia and from The Dial Press, publisher of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen J. Adler. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how John Belushi unintentionally convinced Harold Ramis that he wasn't cut out to be an actor. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Veronica, the new novel by Mary Gateskill. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Harold Ramis. He co-wrote Animal House and co-wrote Meatball Stripes and Ghostbusters, which were each directed by Ivan Reitman. Ramis also co-wrote and directed Caddyshack and Analyzed This and directed Groundhog Day. He directed the new film, The Ice Harvest, which stars John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton. How well did you know John Belushi?
I knew John very well. When I made my first, took my first sabbatical and went to that Greek island, my first wife really wanted to be there. We had read that Leonard Cohen lived on the island of Idra in Greece. It said that on the back of his novel. And she really wanted to meet Leonard, and I was into kind of indulging all her fantasies. So we went to Greece to find Leonard Cohen. This was in like 1970. And while I was away, we spent about 6 months in Europe. And while I was there, I got a letter from Joe Flaherty saying that they had replaced me on stage with a little Albanian guy, and he's really funny. And when I got back to Second City, there was John kind of taking my place, not literally doing the scenes that I used to do, but also standing in the place on stage that I used to like to stand. And I had been the long-haired zany guy, and now he was the long-haired zany. And but together we kind of forged a really good working relationship.
So did you want to come back and retake your spot?
Yeah, but he was already there, and he was so funny. The audience responded to him so quickly and easily that I realized at that moment I might never be the actor I want to be because I don't have his courage or his magnetism. I had skill and I had technique and I had wit, you know, but I didn't have that kind of instant connection to the audience that he had. He would get laughs before he even said a word. He'd walk out on stage and people would start laughing. And it's not because they knew him or expected anything. It was just a look on his face, the shape of his body, the way he moved.
He always had that look, isn't this ridiculous?
Yeah. Well, he practiced looks. John would go home and practice. John could raise each eyebrow independently, and not just, he could raise either corner of each eyebrow. And he would practice looking like Brando or looking like Napoleon or looking like Toshiro Mifune. So we worked together all through the early 70s, and then he got cast at the Lampoon in New York in a show called Lemmings, and then he brought us to New York, and we worked through the Lampoon period. And then we kind of drifted apart when he started doing Saturday Night, and he asked me to come work on that show, but I was already doing SCTV, and I didn't want to jump ship. And then the movie thing started happening with we were writing Animal House, and I thought I was pretty much done with sketch comedy, and that we'd meet again on the films, you know, but before that happened, he was already gone.
How come you became such good friends and collaborators as opposed to you hating and resenting him because he'd taken your spot and you felt performed even better than you did?
Well, I had that with a lot of people. You know, when I first saw Bill Murray work on the stage, he was amazing, and I knew I could never do that. And, of course, I resented it a little bit, but I say this to students now when they ask how you get successful, film students, and I always say, find the most talented person in the room, and if it's not you, go stand next to him. You know? just hang out with him. Do, you know, try to be helpful. and so, you know, those are a lot of the creative alliances I formed were with people who were just bolder and braver. You know, directing Chevy Chase in the early days in National Lampoon's Vacation. And in Caddyshack, you know, Chevy did things I could never do. As a writer, I could write for him. I could imagine great things for him to do, but I could never have done them myself. So I had that relationship with John, with Chevy, with Bill, and later with others, I think.
Now, you were one of the writers for the National Lampoon show, right?
Yes.
The traveling show.
Yeah, we toured a little bit.
Okay. I'm going to tell you one of the most obnoxious things I've ever done in my life. And it relates to the National Lampoon, which is why I'm going to tell you. In 1973, maybe? My guess is that it was 73. In Buffalo, New York, where I was living at the time, I went to see the National Lampoon show, and I was sitting on an aisle. And Chevy Chase, in one of his sketches, played this biker maybe at the Woodchuck Festival, the parody of the Woodstock Festival?
Yeah, this would be the show Lemmings, yeah.
That was Lemmings. Did you work on Lemmings?
Yeah. No, I worked on its successor, the National Lampoon show.
Okay. Yeah. So he comes up the aisle, you know, in his kind of biker drag, and looks at me, points to me, and starts saying, "Hey, Four Eyes," and starts doing this whole riff, and I forget exactly what the riff was, but like I said, this is the most obnoxious thing I've ever done in my life. For some reason, I was offended, and I didn't think it was funny. And I went backstage when the show was over. This is so horrible. And I said, I did this whole, "How dare you talk to me like that?"
I think that's okay. I do.
Oh, I just think it's just so awful and how humorless I must have been. But for some reason, I was really annoyed with the whole thing.
Well, let me tell you my story. You know, when we were doing our show, the Lampoon Show in New York, we had done the National Lampoon Radio Hour, and we had a lot of freedom. A lot of the pieces were very imaginative and fanciful and satirical and a lot of good things. When we started doing our show on the stage, it was very kind of abusive of the audience, and it was rude and it was crude and very hostile in a certain way. And that's not me. So after a couple months on that show, I thought, you know, this doesn't feel good to me. I don't like abusing the audience in this way. I don't know what we're saying to them, and I don't know why we're saying it. And I left the show, and that was when that was in the like spring of '75, and that's when Lorne Michaels came in and picked John and Gilda Radner for Saturday Night. So I'm not saying he would have picked me had I stuck around, but you know, being in New York on stage was a good thing for all of us. But I just didn't like the show, and I didn't want to be associated with that energy in a certain way.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So I get it. I see how you feel. You know.
So is that why you left? You left because of that?
Yeah, but also I was offered the chance to be head writer and director of a serial on public television in L.A. We made it for KCET.
Huh. Well, I still, to this day, feel very stupid about that. I think there was also this kind of implicit insult that he was doing, like like an anti-feminist thing or something that really rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, I remember him staggering around with a beer in his hand and splashing beer on everybody, doing that character.
Right, and I remember when I went backstage, he said to me, "Don't cramp my style."
He said that?
That's what I remember.
Oh man. Well.
But, yeah.
And where is he today?
That's right. And what did he become? I showed him a thing or two.
Yeah. Well, part of the Lampoon philosophy was that there were no limits. You could say anything. And, you know, they did a lot of, you know, sacrilegious, you know, anti-religious material and certainly a lot of political stuff. And, you know, nothing was sacred, not even death. I remember in that Lampoon show we did, Gilda Radner played a blind Mary Tyler Moore. I think it was a sitcom parody called Rhoda Tyler Moore. And John played a literal blind date, a guy who came over, and when he realized she was blind, he started taking advantage of her in ways that were not very nice. You know.
My guest is Harold Ramis. He directed the new film, The Ice Harvest. He co-wrote Animal House and Ghostbusters and directed Groundhog Day. He also co-wrote and directed Analyze This. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Harold Ramis, and he was a head writer on SCTV. He co-wrote Animal House, co-wrote and co-starred in Ghostbusters, directed and wrote Groundhog Day, directed Analyze This and Analyze That, and now he's directed the new film The Ice Harvest, which stars John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton. So, in Ghostbusters, you did a rewrite of the script, is that, or you co-wrote it? How did that work?
Danny had written several things for that he wanted to do with John Belushi, and then when John died in, I guess, 81, he didn't want these projects to just die with John. So around, it was in 83, I guess, he took Ghostbusters to Ivan and said, let's get Murray to play, you know, the other Ghostbuster, and Ivan read the script and said, oh, well, let's get Ramis to play the third Ghostbuster, and he'll rewrite it with you. Danny's script was very ambitious and very abstract and kind of weird compared to the movie that got made. And Ivan knew me very well as a writer from both Animal House and Stripes and wanted me to give it shape and give it more edge and more character, but the actual comedy kept getting better and better as we shot the film.
So, what's one of the changes that you made?
Well, Dan's script began with the Ghostbusters already being an established kind of business in New York. In fact, there were lots of Ghostbusters, kind of like pest removal services, like the Orkin men. You know, there are lots of different Orkin men running around. So there were a lot of Ghostbusters. There were already a lot of ghosts in New York, and that's why there were Ghostbusters. And I thought, well, it might be more interesting to take the audience through the process of how the Ghostbusters evolved, and the idea of starting with us as paranormal academics, you know, at Columbia University, and showing our first contact with the supernatural. Because I think, to me, it was a good way to bring the audience to that place, because I thought, well, a lot of the audience will start from a place of skepticism. And if we start the film from a place of skepticism and then bring them to belief, you know, then they'll take the trip with us. And I think that's kind of the way it worked.
I want to ask you about Groundhog Day, which you wrote and directed and, of course, starred Bill Murray. How did you come up with the idea of somebody, you know, of a weatherman who goes to see Punxsutawney Phil on Groundhog Day to see if he's going to come out of, you know, see his shadow or not when he comes out of his hole, and he keeps reliving the same day over and over and over again. What made you think about this?
Well, it was easy. I came up with it when I read Danny Rubin's original script.
Which oh, was, you're a
and
genius.
That's what it was. Yeah. Well, Danny Rubin, who he lives now in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He lived in Chicago for a while. I think he was, grew up in Florida. He was a screenwriter, somewhat of a Buddhist himself. And had written this script with that exact, you know, that was all part of his original script. And I read it, and I thought, wow, this feels like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, but with kind of a more contemporary kind of spin. And I really wanted to work on it. And I wanted to give it more shape, more comedy. I wanted to change the narrative structure somewhat, and also change the character for Bill. So that's the way we did it. I rewrote it myself, and again got writing credit from the Writers Guild, and then brought Danny back and rewrote it with Danny again. And then on the set, of course, Bill Murray makes invaluable contributions, which would be credited if the Guild rules were not so strict.
So it's only because of Guild rules that Bill Murray doesn't have a co-writer credit?
Yeah, I think when an actor improvises that brilliantly, you know, the Guild should have a way to recognize that, but they don't, because there are these quantitative measures that they use.
So is there a scene you could describe that you wrote for Groundhog Day that you particularly like?
I don't think I'd take full credit for anything I can think of offhand. I love the montage of where you really see the repetition working when Bill's trying to seduce Andie MacDowell, and it starts in a bar where he figures out what her favorite drink is, and then next time he orders her favorite drink, which surprises her, and then he finds out what her favorite toast is. So he keeps repeating till he gets it right, basically, and ends up almost seducing her till her own kind of natural goodness stops him. But that whole run of him repeating over and over is so nicely done, and I think Danny and I share that one pretty nicely.
Why don't we hear that?
So, what are the chances of getting out today?
Van still won't start. Larry's working on it.
Wouldn't you know it? Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Jim Beam, ice, water.
For you, miss?
Sweet vermouth in the rocks with a twist, please.
What are the chances of getting out of town today?
The van still won't start. Larry's working on it.
Oh, wouldn't you know it? Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Sweet vermouth, rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine, too. It always makes me think of Rome, the way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
Well, what should we drink to?
To the groundhog.
I always drink to world peace.
Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Sweet vermouth, rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine, too. It always makes me think of Rome. The way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
But what should we drink to?
I like to say a prayer and drink to world peace.
To world peace.
World peace.
The scene from Groundhog Day, and my guest Harold Ramis co-wrote and directed the film. His new movie is called The Ice Harvest. He directed it. Most of your movies are so much movies of your generation, like Animal House, Ghostbusters, you know, Stripes, even, you know, Groundhog Day. But Caddyshack, which kind of fits into that, also stars Rodney Dangerfield, who's very much of an older generation of comics. And I'm wondering what it was like to work with him, and if it had any kind of surprises or any miscommunication because you were of different generations.
Well, Rodney was the hippest person of his age you would ever meet. He was fully as young in his head as the rest of us, maybe even hipper than the rest of us. You know, he was an old hipster. You know, he came up with Lenny Bruce and standing around on the streets of New York when there was a very active nightclub scene, and he maintained that through his whole life. He never really aged in his mind. He had completely adolescent appetites and very little self-control and a great imagination and outrageous sense of humor. I didn't know him before we cast him, but we'd seen him be hysterically funny on the Johnny Carson show, and we had thought about Don Rickles for that part originally, but ended up with Rodney, and I think it was a really amazing choice. For me, he was my point of entry into that story. I was the Jewish kid who stood outside country clubs trying to, you know, peek in through the fence to see what was going on in there. And Rodney came in as this kind of ethnic force of nature, you know, who didn't belong there, but, you know, was just in there by virtue of his personal power and his money. You know, he represented the crass nouveau riche element, you know, that so offended Ted Knight in the film. So that's how, you know, that's who Rodney was for me. Also, I had this notion of Caddyshack being like a Marx Brothers movie. And Rodney was, he was the Groucho of the team. You know, he was the one with the funny lines.
Well, Harold Ramis, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Harold Ramis, he directed the new film The Ice Harvest, which opens this week. Here's Rodney Dangerfield in a scene from Caddyshack, which was directed by Ramis.
I think this place is restricted, Wang, so don't tell me you're Jewish. Okay, fine.
Hey, kid, I'm Al Chervik. I'm playing with Drew Scott today. This is my guest, Mr. Wang.
No offense.
Oh, well, can you maybe have a half a dozen of those Vulcan D-10s and set my friend up here with the whole schmear? You know, clubs, bags, shoes, gloves, shirt, pants. Hey, orange balls, I'll have a box of those. Give me a box of those naked lady tees, and give me two of those. Give me six of those.
Oh, this is the worst looking hat I ever saw. Well, you buy a hat like this, I'll bet you get a free bowl of soup, huh?
A scene from Caddyshack. We learned today that the rock and roll guitarist Link Wray died earlier this month of heart failure. He's been described as the father of the power chord. His best-known record, Rumble, was a hit in 1958.
We'll be right back.
Link Wray. That record was also used in Quentin Tarantino's film Pulp Fiction. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Mary Gaitskell's new novel. This is Fresh Air. In her second novel, Veronica, Mary Gaitskell explores an unlikely friendship between two women, one middle-aged, ugly, and dying, the other young and beautiful. Book critic Maureen Corrigan warns readers not to bother to get out their handkerchiefs, because this is a Mary Gaitskell story, not a Hallmark card or a movie of the week.
Mary Gaitskell is a proponent of the "everything is crap" school of writing. In the opening pages of her new novel, Veronica, a minor character dives into a canal described as filthy with gas and garbage and turds. Welcome, reader, to the world you too will be diving into when you begin Gaitskell's novel. And it's a long, foul swim. 100 pages later, the main character, Allison, moves into a New York City loft apartment. But it's in the meatpacking district, so the view across the street at night is of a warehouse where cow carcasses with slit throats jiggle on a giant conveyor belt. 100 pages or so after that, Allison looks at a snapshot of her just-born niece in the delivery room and sees not the glory of new life, but her sister's extruded red flesh and a bloody cord. Gaitskell's worldview is so insistently focused on contaminants, a truckload of chlorine could be dumped into this novel and it would still be toxic. But not just for the sake of being toxic. That's the crucial thing about Gaitskell. She's not zeroing in on blood and bone and feces for shock value alone. Images like these are Gaitskell's conduit to thoughts and states of being that are almost beyond words. The swim through slime is her route to the ineffable. Veronica is one of those novels where plot summaries don't convey much because its striking achievement is its mood, not its story. But here goes. Our heroine, Allison, is a middle-aged woman sick with hepatitis C. When she was young in the 1980s, Allison ran away from her family in New Jersey. Her boring younger sisters, her adulterous mother, her father always lost in his opera records. Here's how Gaitskell, through Allison, captures teenaged aimlessness of a certain 80s vintage. I wanted something to happen, but I didn't know what. I didn't have the ambition to be an important person or a star. My ambition was to live like music. I didn't think of it that way, but that's what I wanted. It seemed like that's what everybody wanted. I remember people walking around like they were wrapped in an invisible gauze of songs, one running into the next, songs about sex, pain, injustice, love, triumph, each song bursting with ideal characters that popped out and fell back as the person walked down the street or rode the bus. The wild card here is that Allison is beautiful, and she gets discovered on the streets of San Francisco and becomes a big-time model in Paris. It's a world of cocaine and sadomasochistic sex clubs that she grows accustomed to, learning to detach and to see herself and other people as objects. Then, abruptly, she's dumped by her powerful model agent lover, and she returns to New York to make her living as a temp, doing word processing on the night shift in office buildings. That's how Allison meets Veronica, a frumpy, 40-ish, terribly affected proofreader who's in love with a bisexual man. Veronica is described by other people as a fag hag and a model hag, but she and Allison strike up a deep, if sporadic, friendship that lasts until Veronica dies of AIDS. This is the intense period of her life that Allison is remembering in the present time of the novel, now that she herself is middle-aged and sick. Veronica, the novel, is about the deep stupidity of youth, a stupidity that sometimes can be fatal. It's about the cultural stupidity of the 1980s, that decade's recklessness and frivolity. And ultimately, Veronica, the novel, is about nick of time redemption. I shudder to say that because the one thing Gaitskill's story is not is sentimental. Her kind of redemption is contained in a small yet emotionally raw moment. Like other works of Gaitskill's that I've read, Veronica makes me feel overly squeamish, as though Gaitskill is out there on the edge as a writer and I'm the reluctant reader, reaching back for the comforting pieties of the middle brow. But middlebrow literature is comforting precisely because it safely circumscribes the emotions, grief, regret, joy, that Gaitskill's shimmering toxicity ignites.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the memoir Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed Veronica by Mary Gaitskill. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Diane Reeves singing a song from the soundtrack of Good Night and Good Luck. We'll talk with her tomorrow on Fresh Air.
Best beware where you roam.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support for NPR comes from Work Song, Rhino and Starbucks presenting I Believe to My Soul, a CD featuring five soul artists. Information at starbucks.com/hearmusic. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, relying on white supremacists as your sources, we talk with Jerry Mitchell, the investigative reporter whose work led to the reopening of several civil rights murder cases. Also, jazz singer Diane Reeves. She's featured in the film Good Night and Good Luck. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.